Just when I guessed you could not sink any lower, you're listening to the Rish Outcast. Well, you've kind of made your bed, haven't you?
Okay, kids, I'm not really sure what this is for. I meant to record this the other day. I didn't have my recorder with me. And often when I'm driving, I hear the keys do that jingling thing. But it doesn't, I don't pay any mind to it. And then when it comes time to edit, I go, oh, well, that sucks. What else can I say? So anyhow, I didn't have my recorder the other day. Sometimes I will use my phone, the voice memo feature of my phone, but you really hear the engine. The sound quality is poorer. This should be better, but you know, sometimes the sound quality is so bad on my Rish Outcasts that I feel ashamed. And the only solution to that is to not record while I'm driving or do a podcast that dares not speak its name, which is sitting in front of a microphone, usually with fake Sean Connery in the room. I average about one of those episodes a year now. Okay, so I used to be an extra in film and television back in Los Angeles, and before I moved to LA, I had done it a little bit. I did a couple episodes of a television show, and in Hollywood, and probably in Vancouver, and probably in New York, there is enough work that that's a job for people, that you can be an extra. But here, there are currently, as far as I know, two television shows that are shooting. And, you know, there's always going to be a movie, there's always going to be projects. I guess here in the town that I live in, there is a television show that shoots, but it's a sketch comedy show. And while they do use extras, I'll see a call for extras from time to time, but I've never gotten on it. I have volunteered myself to do it and they don't pick me. So yeah, that's what I was saying. Back in LA, that can be somebody's job. And it was my job for, I don't know, a few months when I first moved out there, and then right before I moved back. And that last, it wasn't even a year, but the last 7 month stretch or 8 month stretch or whatever that I did it was the most enjoyable, it was the most lucrative, I guess. I was actually able to pay my bills. I had an agency that would just book me for work, and that's the way to go. I always say that to people. If you go to LA and you want to be an extra, you sign up with an agency your first day. Don't bother trying to compete with all these other people, because you can't. The booking agents have personal relationships with the casting agents. You don't have that. So the booking agent will be the first person they call on speed dial, et cetera, et cetera. And they know the casting agents by their first names. And they, anyhow, sorry, but I wish that I had done that when I first moved to LA, because this was before cell phones. And yes, there were people in LA that had cell phones, but it was, you know, so that you could say, do you want to die today, Sydney? That's what cell phones were used for back then. There was no such thing as texting or any of that garbage, which has made the world a glorious place. Don't get me wrong. I remember, and I've told this story before, but I remember I went to a anniversary screening of Halloween, and Jamie Lee Curtis was a spokeswoman for one of the phone companies at the time. And she said, you know, I am of course paid to endorse, I don't even remember what it would have been, let's say Sprint. But listen, they're so great, I'm gonna let you hear my ringtone. And it was the theme to Halloween. She played it for us. And it was, I was just like, oh my gosh, cell phones can do that? They can play the theme song to Halloween? This truly is the 21st century. I digress. when I first started doing that, there would be a telephone number you could call, and it would tell all of the openings for extras in LA. And if there was a show that you wanted to work on and you fit what they were looking for, you know, we're looking for adults, males 18 to 24, or, you know, we're looking for 18 to play younger, which is what I was, then they would give you the number and you would call and you would submit your name. And you would be competing with tons of other people who had that same telephone number and had the same qualifications of being an adult 18 to 24 or whatever it is. And so you'd get a busy signal a lot of times, or you would call and they would say, oh, you know, we're all booked up. And that's the answer. That's what you want these people to say. One time, okay, so the show Friends was still on the air. And I loved Friends. I loved it. I don't know that I had ever loved a first episode of a television show as much as I did the first episode of Friends that I saw, which was the ATM vestibule. I put it on my Mount Armis, as they say, the greatest of television shows, episodes. Anyway, I called the casting agent to Friends, and she picked up, and I said, hey, look, I really, really want to work on this show, and they say that, you know, it's going off the air. Please, whatever I can do to get on the show, let me know, and I'll do it. And she said, okay, well, let me be frank with you. The Friends set, you know, it's usually Central Perk that we book for, and they're very specific in what they want. They really want good-looking people in the background on Friends, and so you wouldn't be able to work on it. I'm sorry, but there are other shows that I book for, and I never heard that before or after. And it, so it made an impression on me, and of course I never tried to get on Friends again. But that was really exhausting, calling and hearing, oh, we're all booked up, or busy signal, because I didn't have a cell phone. So I had to do it from home, which was what I usually did, or from a payphone, which is no fun, but there were payphones in those days. And then the third option was when I worked on a show, like at Warner Brothers or something, there would be phones that were made available for extras in every single shooting stage. And so there would just be a line of us trying to book ourselves on these free phones, these courtesy phones. And it was rough. I don't know that I could have afforded a cell phone, but people would get cell phones, extras would get cell phones because they needed it. And if I could go back and hit myself up when I first moved there, I would have said, okay, first off, here's $1,000. Here you go. You need to sign up with an agency and you need to get a cell phone. Because once I had a cell phone, the agents could call me and say, you know, are you available tomorrow? You know, we'll book you on this. Anyhow, I no longer live in Los Angeles. There aren't enough opportunities and there aren't agencies that will book extras. There are agencies that will book real actors, but they book them for auditions and stuff. And boy, how much of a deep dive do we want to go in this? Maybe this should just be an extra talk episode. I even can call it like the extra episode and people will be like,
oh, he just did an extra episode.
Okay, nobody who listens to my show talks with that accent. I'm sorry. So I eventually got work at a temp agency after the extra thing was just, it wasn't paying the bills. I had no money ever. And that's an exaggeration. There were times, there was a movie, an Ivan Reitman movie that we shot. And we were shooting it in a mall that had been damaged by the Northridge earthquake in 94. And it had so much like structural damage to it that the city said you can't reopen this mall. you're going to have to knock it down and rebuild it. It was a mall that was built in the 60s. So rather than knock it down or rather than rebuild it, the city of Los Angeles had closed it down and they just owned it and they used it for filming. Anytime something needed to be shot in a mall or a department store, and I believe that there were certain stores in that mall that were just empty and they could turn them into whatever you wanted. But on this movie, we were shooting in that mall, and it was, I believe it was a Sunday, and Monday a new production was coming in. So they had to get everything shot that day. And I remember there was buzz when we first got there in the morning. We got there early in the morning, like 5:30, 6, that today's going to be a long day because they've been delayed throughout the week and they've had to push everything to today. And this is a story that I really like to tell because I was sick. I was super sick the night before. I was throwing up. And I had never done this before. I'd never called and unbooked myself from something. I know that people do it, but you don't want to do that. Even then, as a naive kid, I knew you don't want to do that. You don't want to be somebody flaky or undependable. And so I set my alarm. Let's say I set my alarm for 5, and when it went off, I was just like, oh, dude, I feel so sick, but I'm not nauseous anymore. I haven't thrown up since 11 or something like that. I'm going to go in because I need this money. And so I went and I got there and I was still sick, but I didn't throw up. And it was a bunch of extras. And we were in, it was a JCPenney, I think. It might have been a Macy's. The whole JCPenney had been turned into extras holding. And there were tables set up there. And there were still like all these empty clothes racks that you used to put clothes on. But there was just so much room to lay down on the carpet and read or, you know, sit down in a chair and talk or eat or whatever. But what I did was I laid down and went to sleep. And they were doing all these setups. They had some special effects shots that had been giving them a really hard time. So 2 hours went by and I slept. Then somebody came in and said, they're still setting up. We've got some breakfast for you. I didn't feel like eating, so I just went back to sleep. 2 more hours went by. To make a long story short, I ended up sleeping for 5.5 hours. And then I woke up and I felt a little bit better. So I started to read. An hour went by, so we'd been there for 6 hours, 6.5 hours. They gave us all lunch, and none of us had still been used. Now, when I say none of us, I fell asleep, so some of them might have been used, but not me. And after lunch, a bunch of people were playing games, card games, poker, and stuff like that, and there were some people playing Mahjong, and I had never played Mahjong. And I was there long enough to observe them playing and then get to play with them and then sort of understand how to play. We had been in holding for, I want to say, 7.5 to 8 hours, and they hadn't used us. And I thought that that was really cool. Eventually, they did start pulling us out, and we started working. And I was dressed as a Cold Stone ice cream employee. And I'll bet that was probably, what do you call it? Product placement. But it might not have been. It could have been that this little spot in the mall had been a Cold Stone creamery in 94, and they had just left it that way. They had, you know, some kind of licensing in the same way that they used to have this deal that if you shot in Times Square, whatever advertising was going on the buildings and the billboards in Times Square, that was contractually there in your movie. Just, you know, it was part of the filming permit or whatever there in Times Square. And then I'm trying to remember what the movie was. At one time, I remember what the movie was. But there was a movie that was just like, no, F that. We're going to make some money. So we'll get some companies to pay to put their product in our movie that we're shooting in Times Square. And we will digitally have those advertisements be the ones that are showing up. And then after that, the floodgates just opened. And now everybody does that. Now you go to Times Square to shoot and you get to decide what's going to be on those big screens. I was a Cold Stone employee and there was a monster. And it was neat because the special effects team had a model of what the monster was going to look like and they showed it to us. But it was actually going to be CG in the final film, and so there was nothing there. We were all terrified and running and screaming from the monster that was not there. There was nothing there. And that was interesting. I was still quite sick. And so in the scenes where I had to run from the monster, there's this thing called performance energy. And I don't know if that's an energy drink or if it's really a thing. But like when you're on stage, when you're performing in front of an audience or whatever, your body will sometimes give you a burst of energy and you're no longer sick. And then the moment they say cut, then your body goes, whew, now you can be sick again. And that's what happened with me on that. Every time it was time to run and scream from the monster, I was okay. And then when they did another setup, I was just like, oh gosh, I should lie down again. I mean, 6 hours of sleep or however much I had was not enough. About the time that they took us to set, there started being this rumble among the extras of, guys, we may actually get golden time on this. And the deal at the time, the deal in Los Angeles was, whether you work for 5 minutes or whether you work for 7 hours and 59 minutes, you are paid for 8 hours of work. That is the regular work day, 8 hours. And that they would subtract the lunch from that. So you could be on set for 8.5 hours and only get paid for 8 hours. But like I said, you could also be on the set for a half an hour, for 20 minutes, for an hour and 15 minutes, and you're still paid for 8 hours. And I used to love that when I would work on a show. I would work there for an hour. They'd be on the ball and say, okay, we don't need any of you guys anymore. Thanks. And I still had the whole rest of the day. Sometimes I would call my agent and say, book me again. But usually no. Usually I'd go to a movie or something like that because I wouldn't be home. I would be out wherever we were shooting the show. So there was this rumble. Because we had already been on the set for 8 hours, for the next 4 hours until you reach 12, it's 1.5 hours. And then after 12 to 16, it is double time. And if you were a non-union extra, which is what I was 98% of the time, that's the ceiling. Double time is the ceiling. But double time is great. But if you were a union extra, once you hit that magic moment of 16 hours and 1 minute on the set, this thing called golden time kicked in. And we had all heard about it. None of us had experienced it. Although every once in a while you would run into an old lady who would be like, oh, back on Lost World Jurassic Park, we had golden time. You know, that kind of thing. They said working on Lost World was the shift of dreams. And it was. I should have said working on Titanic, huh? That would have been cute. Golden time was you would get paid a full day's wage per hour over 16 hours on the set. And just working as a union extra in the union, that seemed like a dream to me because of how well they were treated, how much they were paid. But the idea of golden time was magical. But like I said, the production, I think it was Fox, I don't remember, had to get everything done in the mall that day because the next day a new production was coming in. And so they were under the gun. They had to get it all done. And a 12-hour mark hit. And so all of us were happy because we were no longer making time and a half. We were making double time. And they sent some of us back to holding, but we're still being paid. You're still on the clock. And they just kept shooting. They kept shooting. And there were a couple of times when they would shoot like up at the monster and they didn't really need extras, but they knew that they would need us again. I'll bet we were in holding for another 2 hours or whatever. And they brought us out. And so now we were at 14 hours and there was a moment where like a bunch of us were supposed to congregate and say, what is that? What? You know, of course we don't get to say it, but act like we're saying that. Because if you say, what is that? Automatically. And in those days, it was super easy to remember because a speaking line, a single line was $1,000 right there. It was a super easy number to remember. What is that? Cha-ching. There you go. $1,000. And when I started doing extra work again in 2005, by then the number had gone up. It was like $1,150 or something like that for a line or something like that. It didn't matter. I never got a line. There was this thing called Taft-Hartley. You could be Taft-Hartleyed into the union. If you were a non-union extra like me, and you were on set and you were the right place at the right time and the person who was supposed to deliver the line didn't show up, or the director just said, you, I'm going to give you a line. It was always a pretty girl that would get Taft-Hartleyed, always. And that's fine. But you would go from being paid, you know, $60, $75 or whatever that day to $1,000. And you would be automatically a union member, immediately, instantly made a union member without having to jump through all the hoops that I had to jump through, that everybody had to jump through, which was you had to work two union jobs within a set period of time. And to get a union job, somebody had to not show up and there was a slot and they gave it to you. Or you were super friendly with the casting agent and they said, I'm going to do you a favor. I'm going to give you the union slot. Both of those things did happen to me. And that was really nice. But you had to do two of those in a, let's say, 6 month period. I don't remember what the period was. And then you had to pay the $1,100, $1,200 membership fee to be in SAG, in the Screen Actors Guild. But Taft-Hartleyed people didn't have to. They were instantly in the union for free, plus they just got paid an extra $900 or whatever for their day's work. And there was a guy on set of Poughkeepsie Diaries that did get a line. He was a black guy and I didn't know him, but it was, oh my gosh, everybody was so happy for this guy. I don't know that we hugged him, but I remember everybody like gave him five or shook his hand or whatever, because we were on the set, we were shooting this movie, and the director said, you, can you do a line? Can you deliver a line? He gave the guy the line, and the guy said it three or four times while we shot, and that was it. But we were just so, so, so happy, and I remembered this guy because he was a hero. He had run into a burning building and come out with a huge paycheck. And I saw him again like a month later. And I said, you were the Taft-Hartley guy. And he goes, oh, well. And I said, what? And he said, they didn't end up paying me for the line. I got my check and it said featured extra on it. So they gave me like an extra $50 or something. And I was like, oh my gosh, no. Can people do that? And of course, the people in power can do whatever the F they want. They can take a girl in the back and say, you know, we want some really pretty girls here in this scene to dance. I'm going to need to see your breasts. Can you take your bra off and let me see? Okay, now I'm going to need to squeeze them. Okay, now let's go on back onto the set. And nothing is ever said about it again. The girl's like, well, what? I thought I was, they can do whatever they want. Because they have the power and we had nothing. And we were told from the very beginning, you guys are expendable. A lot of times you will be treated like cattle. Sometimes the ADs will be nice enough to call you background instead of extras. But extras are what you are. You are faceless, nameless props with legs. The lady over on Gilmore Girls will occasionally call you cockroaches, and she's been known to spit on you. Let us know here on your very first day if you'd like to not work on Gilmore Girls, and we'll put it in your contract. That may sound like a joke that was not funny. It was not a joke. We had no power. We were nothing. We were the lowest of the low. And I've talked about, like, the inequality and stuff, and it just, you know, I remember being told, that water is not for you. You can't have that water. You're an extra? Get back to holding. You need to use the bathroom. No, there is a porta potty for you. You're not to use the flush toilets. Fuck off. So sometimes when I hear about how certain minorities, like religious minorities or women in certain countries, women in this country, I guess, and it makes me more empathetic, I think about the guy saying, you don't get a flush toilet, fuck off. And I think they must get that every single day. But you know what? Those are the exceptions. So you remember the terrible things that happen. But, you know, Sam Raimi came by and thanked every single one of us for working on his movie. Costner did that a couple of years ago. You tell the terrible stories because they're memorable. But it was frustrating when it would be lunchtime and you had to wait until the cast and crew had finished eating. Because, you know, there's food for them and then there's food for you. Or if everybody gets the same food, which is nice, then you have to wait until they're all done. And just this week, by the time it was time for the extras to eat, all the potatoes were gone. And I guess that's not a terrible thing. It's not, I shouldn't be whining about it, except for it's, like I said, it makes me an empathetic person. It makes me think about places where certain people aren't welcome or aren't considered people. And I think, okay, how did you feel when this happened to you? And that might be how they feel every day. I get skittish about saying things like that because I've been burned, I said in a recent episode. But, you know, I hope that if you're the kind of person that can take that out of context and see it in a wholly negative way, twist it, that you will not listen to my show. You're not welcome here. Flush toilets are not for you. Fuck off. Oh, okay. So, yeah, that's right. I was telling the story of on the evolution set. So let me finish that, and then I'm going to grab something to eat. Because if I wait too long, yes, potatoes will be gone. We were told that the potatoes weren't all that good. So, you know, they were doing us a favor. There was cauliflower, though. It kind of looked like mashed potatoes. And so we did keep working. There was a scene where we were all on the upper level of the mall, and they didn't use the upper level very much because there was damage up there. You could see cracks in the walls and stuff. I thought that that was neat. But there was a shot where they had a bunch of us standing and looking. And oh, I already told that because it was like, hey, what is that? I got off on a tangent because I mentioned that, hey, what is that? That was the last thing that I ended up shooting. And I have to say that by this point, it was 15 and a half hours, I think we had been there. 15:45 or something like that. By this point, I felt all right because I had mostly just laid around. Yes, there were a few minutes when I ran in terror from monsters. But the whole time I was so glad that I had not called in sick because I would have been sleeping anyway. I would not have been outgoing, having fun or, you know, anything like that. I would have been homesick and sleeping, and they were paying me for the most part to sleep. That was great. The last thing that I shot was that, what is that scene? And they sent us back to holding, and then there were a couple more setups that they needed to do, and they grabbed some of the extras to do that, and I was not among them. And there were a bunch of people in holding, and they did the countdown of when it was going to be 16 hours. And it was like New Year's. The few union extras were so excited. And I was excited too, just for them. We did the countdown. We reached 16 hours. Yay. Oh, and that was really cool too. During that hour, a lot of the extras that had cell phones were calling, you know, their loved ones or whatever and saying, we just hit golden time on this. I don't believe it. And that is why you fail, really. I think I was in holding for another 90 minutes or whatever. But everybody had this story to tell, that we had worked 17 and a half hours on this show. So it was a whole different day when we were finally wrapped, when we were finally sent home. And some of these people had made enough money that you could, I don't know, take a nice vacation or do a car payment. Or I suppose if you had roommates, you could, that there's your rent right there in one day. And it was a good check. It was the best check that I ever got as an extra, that's for sure. And I don't know why I wanted to tell you that story, but I did. I always meant to sit down and do a bunch of stories because I had interesting ones. Like there was an episode of The X-Files where they blew up a car, and I thought that that was really, really cool. And they blew it up a couple of times. You know, we had to reset, and then they'd go put more explosive charges in it or whatever. Because we were shooting it at night, you know, the explosion of fire or whatever is what they really wanted. So they were able to do it more than once on the same car. But then they set a guy on fire. And that was really, really, really interesting to watch, you know. I mean, of course, he was all in protective gear, and then they had put this, like, Vaseline-type gel all over him that was supposed to be non-flammable, you know, it was another level of protection kind of thing. And that was really, really interesting. You know, they set the guy on fire. They said action. He flailed around. He fell over. They'd say cut. And immediately people would run over with fire extinguishers to put the guy out. That's how I want to go out, actually. I could sit down and I could talk for an hour about my experiences as being an extra. And if you want me to do that, let me know. And I'll jot down like 5 stories that I think would be interesting. I'll just tell the stories and that will be an episode right there. Who knows, maybe I'll be sitting around with time on my hands in the future. And that's a good way to use it. One of the things, so I mentioned the Friends thing, but it's not just that show. It's like, this show that I worked on just now, there were multiple, like absolutely gorgeous people that were on the set. And for the film industry, that's just typical. You remember that? I remember there being this part in Last Action Hero where they go into a video store and there's like a supermodel behind the counter. And the kid says, you know how I know this is a movie? Look at the girl running the counter here at the video store. It's like, no way that would ever, only in a movie would that ever happen. And that's typical on a set, on this TV show that I was doing, just right next to me, like reach out my hands and they would be wandering. That close to me was this tall, stunning brunette with like super long hair. Well, she had long everything. At one point I said, hey, how tall are you, if you don't mind me asking? And she said, oh, I'm, you know, I'm 5'9". And I was like, no, I'm 5'9". How tall are you really? You know what I mean? And these super, super attractive girls in real life, one of them, just one, walks into a room and all eyes would turn because they're, you know, they're black swans. They are the opposite of a dime a dozen. Yet, on this set, you know, of a TV show, there were multiples of them. There were tons of them. And you know, super, super handsome, chiseled jaw, male model looking guys too. I just don't notice them as much. And yeah, there will always be opportunities. There will always be slots available for the super, super attractive. But I noticed a disadvantage for the first time. Well, you know, if you consider never being able to buy a drink for yourself a disadvantage, well, there's two. But what happened was when the ADs, when the assistant directors would come in and choose which extras they needed for a particular shot, they chose the really gorgeous ones first. And those are the ones that they put right there by the principal actors. And that's typical, like I said, all doors open for the attractive. And, you know, I've heard it said that being white in America is like playing a video game on the easy setting. And it's hard for me to accept that because, you know, not always is my life easy. But I have noticed places where it's not fair, things are not equal, and where, yeah, me being white means that if the doors don't open automatically for me, but maybe they're not locked. How's that? So same thing with the extremely attractive. That's something where I'm on the outside and I notice it, and it's hard not to notice. But for once, there was a disadvantage to this, in that these people, like the super tall model-looking girl that was next to me, really, really attractive. Can't oversell that. They were chosen first to go on the set, and they're put right there in front of the camera by the principal actors. But that means that they work on every setup. That means that every shot, they have to be there on set, while the rest of us are just waiting to be used. The people around me were all on their phones, were playing video games. A couple of them were reading. A couple of them were sleeping. And if none of those things, they were socializing. They were just sitting there, eating snacks and waiting to be used, while the really attractive ones were on set with the hot lights, having to sit still, not having anyone to talk to, because extras aren't, you know, we always get blamed if there's too much noise on the set. Yeah, see, there you go. I want to get off on a tangent because it's something that I noticed over and over and over and over again as being an extra. Remind me sometime. And yeah, there was one person there in holding that was writing. And that was me. But isn't it a great opportunity that I had to be paid to sit and write and then wait, you know, to be brought on set? Yeah. I guess that's lucky. The thing is, when that episode of TV airs, the really attractive ones will be in the episode. And the rest of us will be, at best, a shadow. And at worst, we had no business being there in the first place. We don't show up. You can't see where we even were. I remember the first episode of The Practice that I worked on. I played a bailiff in the courthouse, and when the prisoner was brought forth to appear before the judge, he's in like his orange jumpsuit, and he had, I believe they were rubber handcuffs so that they didn't jingle. But I led him into the courthouse, and I was just right there with my hand on his arm, and I was thinking, oh my gosh, I am going to be all over this episode. Because every time he has a line, or, you know, when he's brought in or whatever, I'm right there with him. This is going to be great. So the first episode of The Practice I ever watched was this episode that I knew I was going to be in. And the camera was in tight. So in one shot, you saw that there was a bailiff with his little hand on this guy's arm. But you never saw the bailiff. You never saw that it was me. There was almost no point in me being there, and it disappointed me. And in those days, when I first started, I'd get disappointed all the time because I would watch shows that I didn't normally watch, hoping that I could see myself. I thought that that would be exciting. And after the fourth or fifth time of not seeing myself, of recognizing the scene that I worked in, recognizing the dialogue, but I wasn't in it, I stopped doing that. I stopped watching shows hoping I would see myself. And then later, when I didn't care so much, every once in a while I would see myself and I'd be horrified by how fat I was. Because it's true, whether you're fat or not, the camera makes you look heavier. And I'm trying to remember, there was some actress that was on one of those shows, and whenever I saw her, I'd be like, wow, dude, she is so thin. But then when you watch the show itself, she looked fine. One more little thing. So while we were in holding, while I was waiting for me to get taken up on set, I noticed, like I said, people doing things to pass the time, and I noticed this young woman, I'll call her a girl. She was drawing in a notebook. She had a sketchbook, and what she was doing was she would draw eyes, human eyes. You know, she would spend 10 or 15 minutes on one drawing of an eye, and then when it was done, she would turn the page and start on another eye. And I looked over at her, and I just found this really, really interesting. And after like the third eye that she had drawn, I was like, you know what, I'm going to go talk to this girl, which is out of character for me. But in my mind, I thought, well, look, I'm going to ask her about her drawing. And if she does it a lot, maybe I'll ask her if she'll do a cover for me. Or if she responds well to me coming over and asking her about her talents, I will find out her name and, I don't know, see if she wants to be touched below the waist. You know, these are things that occur to you. Okay, sorry, these are things that occur to normal people but would not normally occur to me. But in this case, it did. And so I stood up and I crossed the table and went over and sat myself next to this girl. And I said, hey, I don't mean to bother you. I saw you doing the eyes. Is this something that you do all the time? You enjoy drawing? Is it always eyes? Are these a specific person's eye? You know, and she sort of went rigid, like I had put an ice cube down her back or somebody had splashed her with cold water. And it occurred to me that I was making her very uncomfortable asking her about the drawing. She didn't want to talk about it, and she certainly did not want to show me the eyes or the stuff in her notebook. And that bummed me out because, you know, that was not my intention. And I am aware that I have a creepy disposition. But yeah, you know, it's not good to be reminded of that. Anyway, I slunk away and I didn't talk to her again, but I wanted to. I thought by complimenting her on her art and mentioning that I had seen that, you know, it's obviously something she's passionate about, it would endear me to her. But I guess what it is like when I go to the storage unit and I sing a song, if somebody were to walk by, I would clam up and feel super self-conscious and feel like I was doing something wrong. Even if they came by because they said, oh, I was two rows over and I heard somebody singing, I just wanted to see who it was. I think it's, you know, I love Procol Harum, you know? I don't know. Forrest, is that all you have to say about that?
Jenny.
Okay. I don't know how interesting these stories are. Like I said, I have a bunch. Some are pretty cool. Some are not. One of the things that was surprising to me when I first started doing that was that sometimes they would just pair people up. Be like, okay, you know, like there was an episode of Roswell where we were at a concert and the AD, that's the assistant director that's in charge of the extras, came up to me and he grabbed a girl and he's like, okay, here you go. You two are boyfriend and girlfriend, you know, hold hands and listen to the song or whatever. And that was so alien to me. You're probably chuckling. It's like, what's wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with it, except for, you know, in the post-apocalyptic, post-coronavirus wasteland, I guess it could be awful. Just, I found that strange. It was kind of an adventure. In a way, you know, you never knew what you'd be working on. You never knew what you'd be playing. Most of the time, because I was an extra, instead of, you know, an actor, it was unglamorous. It was just doing crosses. A lot of times when I first started out, I was just a student. And yet, for the most part, I really, really enjoyed it. I enjoyed just being this small part of show business. As I've said before, it's not for everybody. I knew people that would complain endlessly about it. And I also knew people that they would get there, they would check in, and they would then they would take off and have like their friend who's on the set let them know when it's time to come back to clock out. I very, very rarely had friends on the set. The first friend that I made as an extra, his name was Eris, and he was an aspiring actor, and he actually ended up being an actor. I would see him in trailers for movies. I don't know that I ever actually saw him in a movie because I didn't watch stuff like Gilmore Girls and Malibu's Most Wanted. But that was a neat thing when I actually did have friends. And you'd see the same faces over and over again because, you know, not everybody is cut out for that. But I think the people that enjoyed it did it a lot. And there at the end, the second time when I had the agency or whatever, it would be really cool to see the same people that I knew from other sets and stuff like that. And you did. I did start to make friends or, you know, people that knew my name, and we would sit together. And right there at the very, very, very tail end, I got a guy who we exchanged phone numbers, and I think we did lunch one time. Then there was this like super handsome guy, and his name was John, if I recall. And he shared a drink with me one time, and I just was like, wow, that's how life is supposed to be. And then, you know, it all came crashing down, and it's a shame because I was enjoying doing that. I would have enjoyed doing it longer. I wanted to be there in that city, and I think I felt like that glass was half full rather than half empty. Now, of course, I'm looking back on it with rose-colored glasses because it's over, right? Except for just this week I got to be an extra, and I suppose that's why I'm doing this episode, is because I thought it would be fun to talk about. I had blogged about it. It looked like I was going to get booked for Wednesday. And then when I told them, sure, yeah, what time tomorrow? On Tuesday, they said, oh, sorry, we already gave your spot to somebody else. And that's the second time that they have done that to me. And I got to express to you how much I don't like that. Because there's so little work now in the film industry. There's so little work around here in the film industry that, you know, I need all the hours I can get or all the days I can get. And it was the same guy who screwed me over both times. I guess it's his way of reminding me where I stand and that, you know, there's 1,000 other people just like me that want that spot. And I don't know if it's 1,000, but for every 4 or 5 gigs I put myself into the hat for, you know, audition for, I maybe get half of one. I don't know. It pissed me off because I had the booking and then they dropped me. But sure enough, that same day, he called me and said, how about tomorrow? Are you available tomorrow? And luckily, I answered the phone call because it's a new phone. I didn't recognize the number, but I answered it just because it was a local number. And I remember, was it 2 years ago already? I had put my name in for a possible job. And the phone rang, and I didn't recognize the number, and so I didn't get it. And he left a message, and he was a little bit pissy about it. I need you to call me back right now, buddy, that kind of thing. And so, I hung up on the voicemail and called back immediately. And he goes, now you have to pick up, don't you? And I just don't understand. I mean, maybe he deals with people screening their calls all the time. And that was ultimately the one where they dyed my hair and did my makeup. And then the guy showed up that I was supposed to be replacing. And so they didn't use me at all, except for I had my own trailer. I did talk about that, right? I'm sure I did. I don't make friends easily, I guess, is the point I was trying to make. And I wish that I were able to make a better impression on this guy. There was an older lady that used to be basically the area casting agent. And I had tried to befriend her because I would see the people on the set. And when she'd show up, they'd run over to say hi to her or to hug her or something like that. And I thought, okay, the people that do this, she's going to remember. And so I made it a point of every single time I worked on something, I would thank her for getting me the gig. And then she retired. And I guess this guy was her assistant or was a competitor. And now he's the big kahuna. And I don't like him as much. There is just an attitude to the guy, but he recognized me as soon as I came in, and I did thank him for the gig, of course, at the end of the day, and I will try to always do that. Okay, so I guess that's what we're talking about here. So they made all of us sign a non-disclosure agreement on this project, and when I was in L.A., I signed one once when I worked on Desperate Housewives, that you wouldn't tell people the, you know, plot twists and all that stuff that you were privy to working on the show. And since I didn't watch the show and didn't care, I signed it and it was not a big deal. I didn't have to sign another NDA until the Super Bowl commercial that I did a couple of years ago, where I was sitting and writing what ultimately became Choice of a Sidekick. I never really talked about that because they had said this is a Super Bowl commercial and the Super Bowl is in a couple of weeks. You're not really allowed to talk about this until that commercial has aired. And so I didn't really talk about it, except for that it paid super, super well. And LeBron James was there and we did a whole bunch of crowd shots and cheering and reactions and all that stuff. And then when LeBron actually stepped out, there was really just one bit of the commercial left to get, and it was him making a three-point shot. And they told us, you know, you're all watching, and when he makes the shot, you stand and cheer and just go nuts. So this was at the basketball stadium, right? Obviously. Stadium? Is that what you call it? Arena. How's that? And he would shoot for the basket, and we would get ready to stand up. Some of us would still stand up, and he would miss. And so they would reset. Ready? Go. And he would miss. And he would miss. And he would miss. And it blew my mind that he couldn't make the basket because there's no pressure. There's nobody actually trying to block him. There's no shot clock that is running out. It is just, you know, make-believe, and he could not make the basket. And we just kept, okay, we cheered a little bit, but he didn't make it. So we all sit back down. They reset marker, and he'd try it again, and he would miss. And I don't know how many takes they did, because scared of that NDA that I signed, I didn't want to blog about it or record about it. But I think it was like 12 or 13 takes of him trying to make this three-point shot. And on the 14th take, he sunk the basket. And we were no longer pretending. We shot out of our seats and just went crazy because we were so happy that he had made it. And I thought that was a very funny story because, you know, LeBron is a superstar, guys. Like I said, I like working on films and TV and commercials and the one music video that I did. I like it so much that I was an extra on Sam Raimi's Spider-Man for free. In the wrestling scene, at least. The high school scenes they did pay me for, and I was a high school student there. And that was fun. But for the most part, it is fun, and it is what you make of it. I feel like I have talked about this, but I'm going to say it again. At that Super Bowl commercial, there was a guy who was sitting in the row behind me, and he would not stop bitching about how terrible this job was. He just kept complaining and complaining, and they had only booked a few of us. Let's say that they had booked 50 of us, and they were trying to make it appear that all of the stands were full of spectators. And so every time they moved the camera in the commercial, they would move us so that we would be within range of the camera and we would get up and we would move in a different configuration. You know, this guy was in the back, now he's in the front. And then we would just cheer and, you know, clap and whistle and be happy. And then we would move on to the next one. And this guy just kept complaining about it. He said, and I quote, "If I had known that they were going to make us sit here and cheer all day long, I never would have shown up." And I did not get that. I mean, A, F that guy. But two, like, the level of complaining that he was doing, it was ludicrous, dude. I didn't say anything to him. Because what I would have said was, "Hey, I've flipped burgers. I dug a ditch one time for the town municipality. This is not work." It was not hard. It was easy. And you know what? For me, and this is all personal, it was fun to be in a basketball arena and just cheer and hang out with people and get paid good money to do it. It was a Super Bowl commercial, and so they paid a lot. I was just so grateful to be there. Plus, I had a book that I put under my chair every single time, you know, they reset and it was time to move or whatever. I could read a couple of pages of my book. Like I said, I have done it for free, let alone for what they were paying us. But I'm not everybody. Some people would not enjoy it, I guess. I remember there was an episode of a TV show we did where we were in World War II uniforms. It was a USO dance that we were doing in the 1940s. And those uniforms were so itchy and hot and miserable that it was probably the worst time that I ever had as an extra. And yet, you know, when they set action and the music started up and the people were dancing and, you know, when that started up, I forgot how uncomfortable the costume was. And it would just, you know, became this joyful performance. Maybe I'm over-explaining it. Or maybe I haven't explained it enough. But, you know, here we are in 2020 and I still felt the same way. I need to finish this podcast. I ran out of space on the recorder and I had no way of doing anything about it. And so I just thought, well, next time I go for a drive, I'll finish. And here we are. I almost don't remember what I was talking about. Which parts, like, for example, did I talk about the pretty girls? They're just being all these really, really, really attractive people. In case I didn't, I'm going to... The really attractive people got called onto set first, and they worked more than the rest of us, and their day probably went by way faster. But I got a lot of words written, a good day's work written, I feel like. I did some reading. Then when I finally got called to the set, it was just to do crosses, and that means they just need bodies. You're just shadows. You're just amorphous blobs that are unrecognizable as people. But just, you know, they give the scene a little bit of activity and stuff. And so almost every single experience I've ever had with crossing, there's a few people that are playing pedestrians or, you know, something like that, students, shoppers, things like that. And they just walk behind the principal actors back and forth, and they turn around, and there's an assistant director that points to you when to go, and you just walk back and forth. And it will sound crazily pathetic to you if I tell you that I love it. But I did. I do. In the first recording session, I talked about going to the concert for Roswell, and they said, this is your girlfriend. Here you go. Hold hands and enjoy the concert together. And how just mind-blowing that was. Of course, I mean, I'm a social leper. So to have somebody say, here's your girlfriend, I'm just like, what do I do with that information? And in this one, they put me with an older lady. I'm trying to remember. She said her age at one point. She was just chattering on and on. She was so happy to be there, I gotta say. And look, it's always better to be the person that spreads positivity around to the people by you rather than the person that spreads negativity, because your mood can be, I'm not saying it always is, but it can be infectious. And this woman was just so pleased, and she was talking about all the projects that she's worked on as an extra, and it sounds like she works a lot. And my guess is that she is very friendly with this casting agent, this guy that I'm less friendly with. And the AD, the assistant director, was this young, attractive girl, this young woman, how's that? And she seemed inexperienced. I'm not saying she didn't know what she was doing, but I wouldn't be surprised if this was the first project that she has been assistant director on. She was still learning. But I have done this so many times, and the old lady with me had done it so many times. So we tried to help out with all these young people. She paired me up with the older lady, and we just walked together back and forth and back and forth. And I held her arm, and in my mind, I was like, well, okay, is she my mom? Am I married to a much older lady? And there was a girl there, and when I say girl, I mean girl in this case. Let's say she was 19, 18, and she was there with her grandmother, and her grandmother didn't speak any English, and the teen girl would translate everything that the crew said, everything that the assistant director said, and then one of the crew members saw the girl and said, yeah, you, come with me, and he took her inside to be closer to the camera and left the grandmother out there with us. And I could see the grandmother decide. She was frozen there, and she was just like, okay, do I freak out now? I mean, is it better to pretend that I understand what they're telling me? Or do I admit ignorance and maybe get in trouble? And so I took it upon myself that every time the assistant director told us something, I would go over to the lady and tell her in Spanish. And I could tell how impressed the AD was that I was doing that. It was really nice. I've been on film sets where they really appreciate people that know what they're doing. And then I've been on a film set where the director resented that. Yes, once. Once in all the hundreds of times that I've done this, there was a film set where the director resented that I spoke Spanish or that I wanted to help. I never have told that story of the incredibly bad film shoot. I always meant to tell it. Big Anklevich thought that the story was hilarious, and he's like, oh, you got to do that on the Dunesteef. And I never did. And I never did it on the Rish Outcast either. I just... Maybe one day I will, although I forgot more than I remember at this point. The part that made Big Anklevich laugh was when the director said to me, what, you've never squeezed a breast before? Wait, he said titty before. And Big thought that was just hilarious, because my reaction was, not in front of a dozen crew members, well, fuck you. So we did these crosses back and forth and back and forth. It was fun. I wished that I could do that sort of thing all the time. I mean it. I mean, I used to. They sent us back to holding after we finished all this stuff. And I think that's when we ate. Then later, they brought us back for, I guess, what was going to be the final scene of the day, and a final shot of the day, rather. And they had a Steadicam inside. Did I mention that it was in a pizza place? I think I did. They had a Steadicam inside the pizza place that was following the principal actors. So they needed all the seats filled, or, you know, a bunch of the seats filled, and a lot of activity in the pizza place. And so we went in there, and they put me and a guy that I didn't know at a table together, and they brought out this, I think it was Domino's pizza, and they put some on the plate and some on a platter for us, and they had been using the same pieces of pizza all day. So they did warn people, okay, just, you know, you can handle this pizza if you want to. Don't eat it. You'll wish you that you hadn't if you do. And the guy that was at my table, he had a very interesting form of I almost said that he had a very interesting STD. He had a very interesting form of OCD. And it was, his cup had to be aligned. His plate had to be in the right place. The fork and the knife had to be even and pointed right up and down. And he took it as far as the pizza all had to be aligned. No pieces of pizza could be atop one another. And at one point, I could tell he was uncomfortable. He kept looking over at me, and I thought, I know I'm not a good-looking guy. What is the problem, though? I'm not a bad person. Hey. And it was that my fork and my knife were touching each other. They weren't parallel to each other. And I fixed it, and I could see relief on this guy's face. And I thought that that was super interesting. The cast members of the show were all young, and they were super diverse, you know, different ethnicities, different gender, different hair lengths or style or whatever. And I, you know, I guess that's the world that we live in now. I saw Onward, the Pixar movie today, and it had all sorts of that sort of stuff in it, you know. They were all like mythical creature characters, but there was the black one, and there's an Asian one, and there was one that was a paraplegic. And I just found that, there, you know, and there's the lesbian one that such a big deal was made of. And it's one line, guys, and it's not, oh, I love box. It wasn't anything like that. A character said, my girlfriend, and that was it. And that was controversial. These young actors were all very loud, and they're at the peak of their lives. It's not going to get any better than this, kids. I hope you saved some of that money. And they ad-libbed some of their lines. And we did two takes, and that was it. And then they wrapped everybody and sent us home. And I got out of there, and the sun was still up. And I just... Now, I'm not saying that I wish that we had gone longer, but sometimes the days can be really, really long, and I get this sensation of achievement, that I have done something, that I have achieved something, that I have accomplished something after a long day's work. Everybody gets that, right? I don't know. I'm such a lazy person that it's always a surprise to me when I go, oh, I worked really hard today. That felt good. Anyhow, I guess that's it. I guess that's my story. I don't know if it was at all interesting to you, but that was my job for a few months, twice, in Los Angeles, and I miss it. I miss a lot of things. One day, I'm going to look back on the Rish Outcast and podcasting every week, and I'll miss that. I'll miss the people that supported me on Patreon and trying to get a post out every single week. You know, getting together with these people to do shows. I'm recording this in the midst of my exercise every single day and write every single day marathon. And one day I will miss that. I spoke to somebody the other day who said that they feel young. They're older than I am, and they're less healthy than I am. And yet, in their minds, they're still 23 or they're still 15. And sometimes they're reminded that they're not young anymore. And it's a bummer. It's a shock to them because it's like, but I feel like I did when I was that age. So it's possible that I will continue to feel young and to be naive and to be backward and all that. I don't know. You know, the midlife crisis continues, I guess is what I'm saying. And I wonder if I will miss that when that is done. Onward, the movie that I saw today, I cried through most of it. And all I've heard from other people is how badly it's done and how mediocre a movie it is. And I'm not even going to say I guess. I can't agree with that. Well, it didn't make a lot of money, no. But I've never seen a DreamWorks animated film that was as good as Onward. And I cried through a lot of it. It spoke to me. There were some really powerful moments in that film. And the ending, I could not have predicted. I would not have been able to predict how that it would end the way that it did. And that was a pleasant surprise. And as often happens when I see a movie that's either really, really good or quite bad, I ask myself, you know, could I have done better? Could I have written something better? And I thought about it today, and I don't know. I want to be a great writer. I want to write stuff that makes people say, that made me laugh, or that scared me, or that made me cry, or I remember feeling the way that your characters felt. Thanks for writing that. Maybe I'm not there yet. Certainly not with everything that I write. But I want to keep going. I want to one day write something and have people love it. And so that alone is reason to keep going. This has been my extra episode for no extra charge, just the regular price. I have been Rish Outfield, and thank you for listening. Have fun.
Watch this. Creative Commons license. Is that still a thing? Is podcasting still a thing? Are you still a thing? Touché, little pillock. The Rish Outcast is presented under a Creative Commons, non-commercial, no derivatives license. It is free to download, listen to, and share, but is not to be altered, sold, or made claims upon, except by the poor, daft original creator, sitting alone on his bed, holding his knees with his arms like a sobbing fetus. I've always found the word fetus amusing, especially when spelled correctly.
F-E-T-U-S?
No, you Philistine. F-O-E-T-U-S. That's just gross, Fake Sean. I'll take that as a compliment coming from you. By the way, there is a Patreon support account attached to this show where you can pledge as little as $1 an episode to keep it going. You'll get bonus episodes, videos, and the occasional song by Fake Sean Connery. Why, that's me. There alone is reason enough to support it. On behalf of phony Scotsmen everywhere, I thank you for listening.
They put me with an older lady. She was talking about all the projects that she had done, and one of them was that Super Bowl commercial that I was talking to you about. And she was telling these stories to the people around us who are young people, young, you know, handsome people. And she was talking about working with Kevin Costner, and the girl across from her, did I talk about this girl that was drawing? And she's like, I don't know who that is. And so the lady proceeded to name off like 5 or 6 Costner movies. And the girl was like, no, Never heard of any of that. And I heard the lady say, you've never heard of Dances with Wolves, seriously. And she's like, no, never. So she got on her phone and she got a picture of Kevin Costner. And it was, you know, Kevin Costner circa 1992 or something like that. And said, this is him. And the girl was like, no, I don't know who that is. I'm not saying that that means that she sucks or anything like that. I remember when Spider-Man 2 came out, there were a bunch of young people that were bitching about the raindrops keep falling on my head part. And I talked about how stupid young people were, that they'd never heard that song, and that they complained, you know, that that sequence ruined the whole movie. And my best friend took issue with that. He said, yeah, just because you've seen this old movie that has that song in it doesn't mean the people that haven't seen it are stupid. And I said to him, it's probably the only time I ever had backbone. I said, that movie came out in 1968. I wasn't born when it came out. I'm not saying that you have to have seen that movie. I'm saying the people who complained about that scene are stupid. Anyhow,